From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Great Flood and other mysteries. Here's what's happening. The ISIS terrorist organization now threatening to launch new attacks in San Francisco, New York, and London, according to new warning messages posted on the group's social media channels. The messages carried across the internet feature three cities and call for the terror group's radical ideology to kill them all, according to copies of the warnings obtained by the Middle East Media Research Institute. A Delta pilot who authorities suspect was boozed up was booted off a fully boarded plane in Minneapolis and arrested, according to reports. Gabriel Lyle Schroeder, 37 years old, was handcuffed after 11 a.m. Tuesday after police in Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport found him reeking of alcohol and with a bottle of booze on him. What is wrong with these people? Well, the Federal Reserve, as we reported last night, has cut interest rates for the first time since 2008. It is 0.25, but you know what? It's a start. Well, the second half of the second Democratic primary, it's all over right now. And who won? Well, let's check in with Howard Bloom, who, just to disclose, kind of leans a little more to the Democratic side. Is that correct, Howard?
I'm absolutely a Democrat. So first, the bottom line. It does not look like the Democrats intend to turn the United States into Venezuela. Now for the details. There were 20 Democratic candidates on display in the last two nights, and five of them stood out for their passion and for their ability to articulate under pressure. Those were Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, Pete Buttigieg, and Kamala Harris. However, one candidate stood out for something very different: his ability to reach out across divides, to call on longstanding friendships, and to find togetherness with his enemies. That knitter of enemies was Joe Biden, who reached out one by one to his opponents with fond memories of days when they had done things together and had said wonderful things about each other. But something more important than a horse race between candidates became obvious in the debates of the last two nights. Those debates revealed 13 things you are likely to get if you elect a Democrat, our next president. First, everyone will have health insurance. Second, every child will have free pre-K. In addition, the nation will have comprehensive immigration reform. The border will not be open. But crossing the border illegally will be attacked in civil, not criminal courts. And those who the courts conclude have broken the law will be deported. Then there's climate. America will sign back onto the Paris Climate Accord. The government will take tax breaks away from big oil and big coal, and will make sure that we lead the world in the manufacture of electric cars, advanced batteries, and alternative energy, a lead that is about to be seized by China. The rich and big corporations will be taxed more heavily, but not taxed as much as I thought. In Elizabeth Warren's view, they will be taxed 2 cents more on the dollar once they get past a whopping $50 million. Foreign policy will no longer be decided by tweet. The military will be consulted on issues involving its use before policy is finalized. The USA will get out of Afghanistan and the Middle East, but not on an artificial deadline that makes us vulnerable to attack. The criminal justice system will be reformed so that minor marijuana offenses will no longer land you in jail for years. In fact, marijuana will probably be legalized. Tuition to some forms of college education will be free. Some student loans will be forgiven. None of the Democratic candidates are talking about turning America into a socialist state. None are talking about seizing the means of production. All are talking about adding to the forms of competitive support that free public schools gave the United States in the 1800s. At a time when free primary school education was called an intrusion of the state into the private life of the family. All 20 Democratic candidates are talking about 21st century advancements and the kind of social services that arose 400 years ago in Britain when town fathers realized that they'd rather feed the poor at night than find dead bodies littering the roads and the paths in the morning. So you could argue that all the programs that Democratic candidates are talking about are forms of support that a capitalist economy needs to compete. Without a well-nourished, healthy, well-educated workforce, big corporations abandon your country and move to another nation, which is what's happening now. 5 days ago, Time magazine reported that cutting-edge tech firms are moving to Canada because they can't find enough workers with advanced education here. But the candidates claimed there were far deeper issues underlying these debates, issues in the realm of what candidate after candidate called morality. Marianne Williamson declared that we need redemption from, quote, the dark psychic force of collectivized hatred. Amy Klobuchar claimed that we need to replace, quote, a guy in the White House that has now told over 10,000 lies with honesty. And Joe Biden concluded that the 2020 election is a battle for the soul of America.
And I got to tell you, though, Howard, you know, we're nonpartisan here on the program. And at this point, I do not see a formidable Democratic candidate who could beat President Trump. I'm making my own prediction right now. That could change.
It's tricky because the most impassioned and articulate people are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and one of them comes across like a wiry, nervous school marm.
They can't beat President Trump.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky.
All right, Howard, thanks. Keep your advice on there. We'll have Dr. John Curtis on in the future to get his side of the story as well. A woman in Mexico died after getting severely burned during a hot stone massage. The tragedy unfolded at a boutique in the western Mexican city of Guadalupe when a machine used to heat the stones caught fire. The fire spread to bandages in which the woman's body was wrapped, leading to severe burns on 90% of her body. She died in the hospital. She sad story there. 2008, a team of scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey used complex computer models to simulate what would happen if a 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck the San Andreas Fault in California. The report titled Shakeout estimates that the quake would kill 1,800 people, rupture 966 roads, 21 railroads, 32 aqueducts, down 141 power lines, and damaged 300,000 buildings. As many as 270,000 people, they say, across Southern California would be displaced from their homes, and about 500 public shelters would be needed to house roughly 175,000 of those people. Cal Ori, of course, the author of The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, who predicts earthquakes herself and has been pretty uncanny, is with us right now. Cal, you know, you just about called those earthquakes we had a few weeks ago in California. You said something was happening, and it did. What do you think about the big one?
Well, I've got my prediction. Let me tell you something first, though. The aftershocks are still going on in that Ridgecrest area that's not real populated. East of greater Los Angeles, that's why we didn't have any deaths, maybe one related, I don't know. But people are concerned that these aftershocks are doing what I predicted would happen, move toward to the dangerous faults, triggering the big one. 7.9, it's really 8.0, great, but 7.8, 7.9 are the numbers I'm seeing. And what I read, the two fault lines, Garlock and Owens Fault, they actually can cause a great quake. There was a 7.9 in 1872, and that Garlock Fault, G-A-R-Lock Fault, 8.0+, could actually send shaking into the L.A. counties. My prediction, here we go, for the big one that we've all been waiting for, we had a major quake, the 7.1. Remember, great,
that's right.
8.0, but if it's shallow and 7.0, that's 7.9, that's going to be great. I'm going to say any time from now until October, which Berkland taught us is a shaky month.
And, Cal, if animals can predict earthquakes, sounds like your dog feels something's happening back there.
I hate to tell you this. Don't get nervous, but guess who's right in my lap?
Oh, boy.
I've been trying to get outside again. My Siamese cat, and he's really spot on. And we did feel that quake up here. People felt it in Las Vegas, the Ridgecrest quake.
They did.
7.1 all the way to Reno.
I felt the 7.1 in our building, our studio in L.A., and I didn't think it was going to stop. It just kept going and going and going.
What floor were you on?
I was on the fifth floor.
You know, I still think I'm going to Alaska and Anchorage. They had the 7.0, and I backed out of the Barnes & Noble book signing, and now they're all mad at me. But I was freaked because, I don't know.
Well, let's keep in touch on this, Cal, because your predictions have been pretty spot on. In a moment, we're going to talk about super soldiers and other sci-fi stories with Peter Ward next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Peter Ward back with us. Peter has been very active in paleontology, biology, astrobiology since his PhD in 1976. He has published more than 140 scientific papers dealing with paleontology, zoology, and astronomical topics. He is an acknowledged world expert on mass extinctions and the role of extraterrestrial impacts on Earth. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Hey, George. It's great to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure. Things just keep happening. They don't stop in our world, do they?
They don't. And one of the things that didn't stop me last week was going to San Diego to Comic-Con, my very first one ever, and that was a zoo.
It is a zoo. Great people down there, lots of spectators. And did you have fun?
Well, I did, but there were 140,000 paid people there. And the trouble is there were so many people trying to get into the various venues, they started selling the right to sleep out so you could be in the line that might get you into the venue the next day. I was actually talking about Super Soldiers, so I got in free and got to go to a few of the venues. But first one I've been to, and it was the costumes were amazing. I mean, people were really having a great time.
They do. When we talk about Super Soldiers, Peter, are we talking about high sci-fi?
No, we're talking about reality.
Oh, boy.
And the reality is, of course, if you can insert a gene to increase whatever soldier needs, the soldiers need to be able to be efficient, to kill easily, but to be strong, to exist with very little water, to go without sleep, to do without much food, to be smart, to be tall, to be big. Each of those things actually can be enhanced by inserting just one gene. We know this is the case. The Chinese inserted one gene into a couple of dogs, whippets, tiny little skinny dogs, and they turned into these great big muscular brutes, one gene for enhanced muscles. So we know it can happen, and the Chinese also separately, for the very first time, used this technique on a human embryo. They're not supposed to. The scientific world would be crazy, but they did it. They said, yep, we can do this. So, George, do you really think the militaries of the world aren't keeping tabs on this?
Oh, I think they're probably watching it, and you know what? They probably, Peter, have been experimenting on it.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I just think this is the hen is out of the hen house, or whatever you say, or the cats are among the dogs. It's crazy. I mean, the thing is really going to explode, and I suspect it's already taking place in militaries that have technical expertise in biology around the world right now.
How dangerous is genetic engineering? We are playing around with Mother Nature.
There's both the good side and the bad side. I mean, the reason that this engineering is being touted is it can help remove some of the most insidious and god-awful diseases, genetic diseases, that plague mankind. This could be a great boon for good. But as in anything else, George, it's like atomic energy. There's been so much great good coming out of atomic energy with electricity. And yet we know atomic bombs are quite the opposite of that. So it's like the double-edged sword, and that there's so much good and there could be so much bad.
Let's look at those upsides and downsides with genetic engineering. What would you think could be the downside of genetic engineering? What could go wrong, Peter?
Well, so much can go wrong. The thing about genes is that we think that our genetic code is something that's fixed and that during our lives nothing could affect those genes, no genes could be added. In normal circumstances, that's probably correct. But what we're doing with agricultural products, George, more and more, is inserting genes that can make our yield be better. So, for instance, if you want to be able to kill more bugs, why not insert a gene into the insects you want to live, like bees, that you're not putting into the insects you want to kill, like the roaches and the weevils? So what you can do is put pesticide all over the field, the bees live, all the bad bugs die. Do the same with pesticides and herbicides, try to get rid of the bad weeds but let the corn exist. The problem is genes don't stay in the bottle. The genie or the genes always jump out of the bottle, and the wishes you usually get aren't anything you really want. We have genes escaping in agricultural fields now. It's going to happen. It has happened. And as we get more sophisticated in putting artificial genes into things, the consequences can be disastrous.
Well, you know, that's exactly right, because in most movies about genies popping out of the bottle, they give an individual a wish, and they always preface it by saying, but they all have consequences. So you know, you may want to wish for, you know, an unlimited amount of money, but then he turns you into a human with no arms and legs. You know, you're the richest guy in the world, but what can you do?
conundrum, all right? I mean, science is obviously for such great good and for so many positive aspects. On the other hand, there's always a dark side. And what we have to do is come up with some sort of new way of controlling this particular genie. It's equivalent, George, to atomic energy in, say, 46 and 47, where only a very small number of humans could harness it. But more and more wanted it, and you had more and more bad actors who could understand I could use this for evil as well as good.
Peter, didn't Albert Einstein kick himself after he came up with his E equals MC square formula?
You know, that guy is such an interesting character. When I went to graduate school, George, at McMaster University, right by Toronto, they had his brain. After he died, somehow the Canadians, where I went to school, were able to obtain the brain, and they found it was anatomically quite different from normal human brains. They had many more ridges. So who knows what that guy was thinking?
Well, that's true, too. Now, with the genetic engineering, what are the good things that could happen?
Well, we need food. We've got more and more people. How are we going to feed them? So what we can do is start engineering certain plants to have a greater yield. As there's more and more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and things turn into greater heat for fields, and we've seen the scorching summers. I mean, George, did you see what's going on in Europe?
Oh, it's horrible.
And Alaska, horrible. That's the one that struck me. I mean, I've seen the heat waves in Europe.
Oh, they're having fires like crazy out there.
Well, I mean, it was in June that Anchorage was 84, 85 degrees.
Yeah.
It's like crazy. So you can engineer plants and put in genes that allow them to withstand greater heat. So those are the good things. I mean, we really will need more food on this planet as our population goes from its current 7 billion and change to up to 10 billion. How are we going to feed everybody? And so here is the best possibility of moving forward, is genetically engineer certain crops to have greater yield, to have shorter times to fruition, that seeds germinate better, that we get rid of pests in greater extent. It's all the stuff that can feed us. Those now, are, I think, the greatest things.
And, Peter, though, I got to tell you, I'm not a GMO type guy. I'm opposed to genetically modified foods because I think they're going to screw it up.
Well, they are going to screw it up. The genes do jump, and the Europeans are certainly pointing out this. But on the other hand, there are legitimate reasons to accept some of these. You can almost make the analogy, George, is you're not opposed to antibiotics, are you? I mean, this is something new that was.
No, but they can be abused.
Well, they can be abused, but it's something modern society has finally accepted. We all have to make choices, and the choices now are we have to feed the world, or the amount of conflict just raises exponentially. So the genetic engineering is here to stay. Nobody's going to stop it. And it is a case of can we regulate it and can we put in safeguards? And that's where the arguments really need to be among most concerned people. And trust me, we should all be concerned about this.
What if the super soldier who's been modified becomes a super monster?
Well, how could it not be a monster in a way? I mean, what do you do when you have...
It's a Frankenstein.
Well, it's such a science fiction trope. You know, there have been any number of I think the brand new Fast and Furious features Idris Elba. He is a genetically modified superhuman. It's in the theaters this week. It's not just sort of theoretical, though. We haven't yet produced super soldiers. And the question is, will we let it happen, or will there be some sort of scientific or government, or how do you stop it? I mean, who has the control of the biological labs? This is a case I've been trying to make. There has to be control somehow. I mean, there's just too much possibility of disaster by genes jumping into the wrong creatures.
Is the United Nations doing anything to control this as an organization, as a group?
Have you ever known them to be effective at anything, George?
No, sir, I have not.
Committees, and it's just, again, it's very similar to 46. Scientists were all wringing our hands about atomic energy. Oh, my gosh, we can't let this happen. We're not going to let the government have it. The scientists are noble scientists. We'll keep it. We'll make it safe. And the U.S. government said, okay, thank you for the bomb, and now go away, and the government will take care of it. So we're in a place where no one has really the ability to say, don't do that. And you can tell them. Do you think anybody in China is saying, don't militarize this? So DARPA, I know our defense forces, they are looking at it. The Europeans are. Everybody has to. It's another arms race. The arms now are genes.
We're going to come back in a moment with Peter Ward and talk more about his work, Genetically Modified Humans, on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about super science with Peter Ward, and we'll take calls with Peter next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. You know, we have a YouTube channel. Go ahead and take a look at it. I hope you enjoy it. All you have to do is in the search bar at YouTube, put Coast to Coast AM Official in there, or we've got a direct link with our icon, the YouTube icon, at the top of our homepage at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment more with Peter Ward as we talk about super science on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Peter Ward, with us. Peter, at the university level for kids that are going through school and college, what's the curriculum for them to study gene splicing and things like that? Is it in the biology department, or where would that be?
Yes, absolutely. And biology is the single largest science major at my university, University of Washington, and we've got 35,000 undergrads alone. So it's really a small city in Seattle, and it's one of the largest majors on campus. So many kids are trying to get into biological fields because there are jobs. My university now only takes the very top of the state of Washington students. It's really, really hard to get in. We also take a whole lot of Chinese students from overseas because they pay more. And as in many universities, the state can no longer afford to pay to keep it going, so you bring in foreign students. So we, the United States, are training a whole lot of people in the most advanced techniques. I mean, the great American universities are still better than anything elsewhere in the world, save maybe Oxford, Cambridge, Paris, maybe a few other places. But I mean, this is still the greatest strength our country has, is the educational system and the advanced science that we can still do. But biology, George, has now become a place where you can learn skills that are not always useful for the good. We're going back to the analogy again. Back in the 60s and 70s, you know, the world produced a few tens of really, really top-flight atomic engineers, nuclear physicists, people who could build bombs. It's still really hard to do that. But the advances in biology have been so unbelievable that many of these undergraduates, and again, we produce 800 to 1,000 per year from this one university. So the United States is producing tens to hundreds of thousands of biologists who can have the skill to use these genetics for good or for ill. And so it's really the scary part to so many of us is that powerful, powerful, powerful tools are now available through simple 4 years of biology training.
Now, what happens if a student, a prospective graduate, decides to play around with weaponizing some of these things that are out there today?
How do you know? I mean, how do you know?
How do you know? Why? That's a good question.
I mean, the analogy is the people who are now stealing money from banks and hacking. The hackers never let that happen. The trouble with hackers and the analogy is that hackers are usually trying to make money. Yes, some of them are doing it certainly for the mischief. And we go back to some of the most famous hacks. It is this ego. I mean, the recent one that just happened with
Capital One.
Capital One. That was a woman in Seattle. And she did it just for the ego, showing people she could do it. But what scares me, George, is that if you get some crazy who goes out and takes a gun and shoots kids in school, what if that same person is also brilliant and decides, aha, I now have the tool to make a bigger gun. I have a tool that can make a gun that can kill millions of people.
And is that a strong possibility, Peter?
With the number of people out there and with the ability to mess with genes, absolutely. I was talking to a professor at University of Michigan today. He said the most unholy and the scariest thing we know of is mating those diseases which are easily transmitted. I mean, look at the cold. Somebody sneezes, a little bit of that rhinovirus floats across the room, lands on a desktop. 2 days later, somebody puts their finger on it,
yep.
Maybe puts it in their mouth, and boom. So luckily so far, I mean, the really nasty diseases, Ebola, for instance, these things aren't transmissible easily. Nevertheless, I mean, we still see that many people are contracting it. But if you took the ability of a cold virus and mated it to smallpox, you've got a really bad situation facing you.
Don't you think, Peter, that governments who are, you know, buying weaponry and warfare are doing this already, that they have these things?
Absolutely. I mean, this is going on, and this, the new technique is called CRISPR, CRISPR-Cas9. It's got an amazing history, George. CRISPR was taken by some very clever biologists who understood that way back 3-4 billion years ago, that the way that genes were passed between organisms was usually by a virus breaking in to a single-celled bacterium, injecting its DNA or RNA into it, and then reconverting that creature to produce more of the pathogen. So bacteria way back, and we're talking the Earth's first life on Earth, somewhere in the first billion years of life on Earth, maybe 3 to 3.5 billion years ago, invented a method called hunter-killer. We call it CRISPR. So this is a method the bacteria produced to find the viruses when they invaded and wipe out the genes that they were being infected with. So very clever scientists a decade ago said, hey, let's see if we can do this, and we can wipe out genes and then put in our own genes. So the good news is we can find bad copies of genes that cause these genetic diseases. We find them, we wipe them out, and we can inject a new gene. But if you start doing this with pathogens, I mean, all the good can be turned into one of the worst killers ever. So this is the scary, scary scenario.
It sure is, and very real indeed. Humans are faced every day with all kinds of things, stress, you name it. How can we eliminate stuff like that?
I don't know if you could ever eliminate it. I mean, you certainly hope that the vast majority of people, the better nature of us all, I think, is, you know, I'm an optimist. I do think that the majority of people really have character, that we're basically everybody screws up, but basically everybody, I think, wants the best to happen for yourself, your kids, your friends, your family. There are so few of these really completely broken shooters. They cause enormous death and suffering, and the shooting that's been going on for the last couple of years, it's increasing, and unfortunately it is tragic. But compared to what it could be if we mated the genetic engineering to pathogens, and what we're seeing in carnage is nothing.
What do you think of this September 20th event where people want to storm Area 51 in Nevada?
I think it's very funny in a way. You know, the funny you said the word stress, because as you know, last year I was on your show. I published a book called Lamarck's Revenge.
Yep.
And it was for talking about the process called epigenetics, where stress in your life, bad things in your life, can change your DNA. We're not even talking about injecting new genes, but there are genes in you that can be turned on and off. And since the year since I published that book, I've been thinking more and more about stress and stress in the society. Now, the storming of Area 51, I think, is a symptom. I believe that the last 4 or 5 years, American society, European, world society, has ticked upward in the average level of stress of everybody. And I've been thinking about a new book called Stress, A Natural History, because stress in us comes from a molecule that was evolved 500 million years ago in a very slimy, primitive fish called a lamprey. So we have this molecule that never got fixed up. It's like a blunt hammer, and it affects us all in very strange, curious ways. And when stress increases in large numbers of people, I think the symptoms start coming out as this idea that, yes, there have to be aliens in there, and yes, more than 2 million people now, George, are signed up to go storm it. You know what they make there. Your listeners know that.
Oh, yeah.
Skunkworks. That's where advanced airplanes are. Do you think the military's going to let people come?
Nope. I've told people, Peter, do not go.
You're right. It's indication of this sort of mass hysteria that I think too much stress has bombed on top of all of us.
Well, I've never seen a time period where more people are uptight about so many different things. I can't quite put my finger on it. I have my suspicions, but I mean, people are just uptight. I mean, they're loose cannons. Have you felt that?
Yes, absolutely. And I've been talking to psychologists. I know a bunch of them, and just informally saying, hey, look, you know, you've been in practice for some years, and what's the level of stress of the people coming in to see you? Well, maybe that's a bad population because those people are going in because they're under stress generally. But my friends say, yes, you know, it's getting worse and worse and worse. And so the question is why? Is it because there's so many of us? Is it because of technology? Is stress being fomented in us by the devices that are supposed to reduce it? Well, what's more handy than a cell phone? And yet what's more isolating than a cell phone? And what causes more stress than isolation?
Why don't they do something to make people feel good? Why don't they say something like, folks, we're giving everybody $20,000. You got to buy goods in the United States, made in the United States. Here's a list of these products. Have a great time. Have fun. Why don't they do something to make people feel good?
It's funny you say that. I'm a child of the 60s, and just as I was getting into college, they say, hey, we got something here to make you feel good. They called it drugs. So I think in the end, that was such a terrible, bad end for so many people. At this stage, it's really hard for us as a society, I think, to come to grips and even recognize that local stress in everyone is increasing. You know, I've asked us to do an experiment. If we were able to, there's a patch you can put on now. I thought you used to have to take a blood test to measure the amount of stress hormones in your body. Look, George, you're such a pro at this. I was just curious, though, if I did a stress test on you a half hour before the show, and then anytime during the rest of the day, your stress probably doesn't change.
I bet it's the same. I would say it's probably the same.
That's the point.
Nice, now, even keel.
What would happen if 5 nights in a row you called and each of those guests was gone? I would think by the end of the fifth night, your stress would be a bit higher.
Actually, I'd go to open lines.
You've got this whole gig worked out so beautifully.
Yeah, I've got my backups ready to go.
I'm an admirer in it, but I'm also saying and trying to point out that if, say, 5 years ago, we were able to do this stress test on all Americans and compare it to it now and do an absolute quantitative look by measuring this molecule called cortisol. That's what causes the stress. It's a level in your blood. It's quantitative. You can measure it. What if we looked at Americans by age, by gender, by sexual preference, by race, by economic position, and ask what's the mean stress level on day by day to these various groups, and then compare that to even a century ago or 2 centuries or 5 centuries, because now the fossil record can let us look at past stress. There's beautiful techniques, George, that can tell us some of the levels of stress, not only of past humans, but of past animals.
I mean, we've got, for example, Peter, the folks at home listen to the show and, you know, they're happy with it and it's clean and technically great. What they don't hear sometimes is producer Tom yelling in my ear 10 seconds before I'm on the air. I can't find the guest. He's not answering his phone. I don't know what we're going to do. And then, you know, as I'm doing part of my introduction, he's in my ear going, I got him. He's on. And I just seamlessly flow right into it. People don't see that all the time. And that's what real life is all about.
It is, and I have to tell you, I've been yelled at very thoroughly by your Tom several times. And you guys just have this great moving parts machine working. But boy, it's, you don't ever want to get yelled at, and we all peak in stress. So a really interesting next question is, if I'm correct, and if sort of local stress is increasing in the population, and perhaps this idea to build super soldiers because we need better war is just a consequence of greater stress of world leaders, is there an evolutionary consequence?
Well, that's a good point. And what if that super soldier, Peter, says we can get together, let's say there's 100,000 of them, and we can take over this planet?
Well, what if the super soldier says, make some female super soldiers, and our mating now sets us apart into a new human species?
Well, that's a good point. They would literally make super babies, wouldn't they?
Yes, they would. This is one of the things about the Chinese dogs. When they put the muscles in, the muscle gene, it got passed on to their progeny.
Interesting. That is fascinating. You've taken a look at aliens. What's your take on some of this?
I wrote a book years ago called Rare Earth, and actually it's funny, after the book came out in the year 2000, I went to my first Comic Con. It was in Seattle, actually, and I walked in, I had my 16-year-old boy, and we went to, some of the great science fiction writers were there, walked into the room, and this one great famous science fiction writer named Greg Bear said to the 200 people, this is the man who has taken your aliens away from you. And I'm going, oh my gosh, my little son's looking at me going, Dad, they hate you. What have you done? Yeah, well, I keep seeing the funny news articles. Another one today, they're saying, a brand new planet's discovered, a super Earth that must be habitable. And I'm going, look, if it's a super Earth, it's 2 times Earth diameter, the gravity's 2x. Habitable by what, right? Nothing's going to be walking upright like us. Probably, if it's any life at all, it's going to be bacterial. So the hype is out there, and you just have to take it with grains of salt.
Do you think we're alone in the universe, Peter?
Hell no. No, I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to swear. I've been told.
Well, you can get by with that word.
I just think that's impossible. The numbers are so enormous. I mean, just so you look out. I just bought a new telescope, a beautiful 11-inch.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Oh, hell. I was there. Here we go.
There you go again.
And you see so many stars, and you start saying, how could we be alone in all this? The numbers are just so consequential, so large, that even if the chance is very small, which it is, of life forming, and smaller yet, of it finally getting to intelligence, come on. I mean, there's 400 billion stars in our galaxy, of which there are billions of galaxies. You know, it's like Carl Sagan, yada, yada. But nevertheless, it would just be stupidity to believe that we are alone in the universe.
So it is. But, man, I'm fascinated by these recent discoveries of military pilots chasing objects that they can't catch.
It's interesting that it's come back again, and I find it sociologically interesting that I think the pilots have always been seeing things, but the press hasn't picked up much of it, or there are cycles, I think, when either more of them, if they're out there, are coming, or there's something about sociologically our press that is seizing on this stuff. But this has been the summer of aliens, hasn't it? I mean, it was even finally the Senate, didn't they have a hearing on some of the...
Mm-hmm. They've had committees and secret projects and everything else.
It's a new world. So I've seen some of the films. You know, I'm a long-term skeptic of being visited repeatedly simply because our radar and our techniques and our technology is so good that surely we would be able to finally to definitively either track one of these down or shoot it down or actually get it. But nevertheless, these sightings are getting harder and harder to discount.
Peter, what nation do you think is ahead of the game with this CRISPR gene insertion technology?
I think a more proper way to think of it, George, is what military? Because I think nations and militaries are separate entities. I don't really think our government really has a very good idea of what our military is up to.
Probably not.
And we certainly... China, for instance, has a very advanced research into genes and genetic editing. And I did research on this trying to find out. DARPA has admitted that, yes, we are definitely looking at this, as DARPA is our defense establishment, the advanced weaponry of the United States. And other countries just aren't saying anything. But you know they have to look at every possibility. And they would be really not doing their job if they didn't explore every possibility of weaponry. So in this particular case, yes, the Chinese are probably way in the lead.
Peter's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com along with all his books that he has written. Peter, when we come back, we're going to take phone calls with you. Did you enjoy Comic-Con?
You know, I did. I really did. It was a beautiful, beautiful day down there in San Diego. It's always beautiful, and I've got my new fiance who's sitting here peacefully in bed right next to me as we do this, and we had this pre-honeymoon, so come on up, George, August 24th, 25th, you can make it to the Tri-Cities, it's going to be a great marriage, and I'd love to meet you again.
Well, that's interesting. I might just take you up on that. That's a possibility. All right, Peter, stay with us. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you as we talk about gene splicing, super soldiers, and all kinds of sci-fi stories. And you're participating with us next, so make the phone call. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.